Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Bashaw. When working with young people, there are many difficult conversations that can arise. Some of these come unexpectedly from the young person, others we choose to bring up. One of the most difficult for many people is the topic of suicide. In the USA, suicide is the third leading cause of death in adolescents. Accidents and homicide, respectively, are number one and number two. In Canada, suicide is the second leading cause of death, accidents being the first. How do we know if someone's contemplating suicide? Are there warning signs? If we see these signs, what do we do? Are there things that put a person at greater risk for suicide? How do we have these difficult conversations with young people? Today I'm speaking with Sonia McDonald, an instructor with Applied Suicide Intervention Skills Training, or ASSIST, developed by LivingWorks. LivingWorks was started in Canada in the mid-1970s and has helped deliver suicide training in the US, Ireland, England, Singapore, New Zealand, India, Korea, and several other countries. The program has helped train close to a million caregivers from all around the world. Welcome, Sonia, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
As I said in the introduction, suicide can be a very difficult thing to talk about. Why did you decide to focus on suicide?
I was actually in a position with the Canadian Mental Health Association that really led me down that road. Someone approached me about taking on this really great project, doing youth engagement with young people, specifically around suicide. And once I got enmeshed in it, and once we started developing the program, and I started working with the kids, and we started putting together all these great projects, it really became more than just my job. It was very much an interest for me. So I became a trainer, and with the hope of training young people. Of course, we end up training everyone and anyone, but as I've been a trainer now, I guess I'm going to say 7 years now, every time we do a training or every time I do a presentation about suicide, I seem to learn something new. So over the course of the years, I've realized how many people in my life have taken their lives and how much that has affected me when I didn't even realize how it affected my life and how it shaped my career choices.
And would you say that that impact of suicide, you're also seeing that in the young people you do trainings with and trainings for?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I can walk into a classroom and talk to students about suicide all day. They have no problem talking to me about it, mostly because it's there. It's in their face. They think about it. They talk about it with each other. They don't seem to feel the stigma quite as much as we do as adults. And we're finding that, you know, the more they get involved in the trainings and the more they get involved in presentations and projects, the more they feel empowered to support other young people who are struggling, because as we know, young people struggle with lots of different things, so they're feeling very empowered to help.
You talk about stigma from an adult's perspective, and there certainly is a lot of stigma. Why do you think it's important to talk about suicide?
The more we talk about it, the more awareness we'll create about it. I think people sometimes don't feel like it really happens. One of the major myths around suicide intervention and awareness is that it doesn't really happen that often. But you can ask a group of people, and almost everyone has been touched by suicide in some way. When we're looking at statistics for young people, you know, 8 out of 10 kids think about it before graduating. That's a huge statistic. And when we're losing 4,000 people a year in Canada, and those are only the people we know of that take their life, I think it's important to raise that awareness. I think there's a way to do it that's respectful, and there's a way to do it that makes people feel like they can help. And it also makes, the more we talk about it and the more we reduce the stigma, it allows for people that are having thoughts of suicide to really feel like they can talk to someone, so that they don't feel that they have to be alone in the process, and that there are other people out there that have those feelings and other people out there who can help them.
So the more we speak about it in general terms and specific training, the more the stigma diminishes and the more likely people are to reach out if they are having thoughts of suicide.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I think that our job is to reduce that stigma. And if there's still a lot of stigma attached, a lot of taboo attached to suicide, people will keep that to themselves, and we won't be able to help them. And one of the major myths is that if we talk about it, people will do it. But we know from the research and we know from experience that that is the complete opposite. That is not the case at all. When we talk about things and make people aware, we save lives.
If 8 in 10 people are thinking about it and nobody's talking about it, or very few people are talking about it, I think that really indicates quite clearly that people are thinking about it, and it certainly can't hurt to talk about it. You talked about talking about it in a respectful way. There's been a lot of language that has been used over the years around how to talk about this topic. And in the past, we've talked about successful suicides or unsuccessful suicides, or talked about suicide completion. What sort of language is the most effective and helpful and respectful when discussing suicide?
Well, what we're finding now is when people use the words completed or successful, sometimes it makes people feel like someone set a goal, they work towards it, and they achieve that goal.
Hmm.
We're, at a national level, we're really trying to change that language a little bit so that it really hits home for people when you say to someone, someone has taken their life by suicide, or someone has died by suicide. Because people are feeling like committed suicide, successful suicide, people seem to focus on the first word, right? But when we say that someone died by suicide or took their life by suicide, people make the connection that this is life or death. This is not just a topic that we throw around that is, you know, going to be a buzzword for a while, or, you know, we're going to do all these presentations for a while. This is really something that happens to people all the time. This is something that people live with and think about on a regular basis.
Just having you say take their own life or mm-hmm. kill themselves, it shifted how I heard you saying that word. So I'm extrapolating that to working with young people. I can definitely see how that would change.
Well, I think because we also, when we're working with young people too, they often use the word suicide, but they'll use it in a way that's very comfortable for them. So if you change and you reframe it a little bit for them, sometimes they make the connection that suicide means death. Suicide mm-hmm. means I won't be here tomorrow. And part of me thinks that as a child and youth worker, that's part of our goal. When someone's talking to us about suicide, we need to help them realize that they're talking about dying.
That's a really crucial aspect. And some people will talk about that, and other people won't necessarily name it. They won't say, I'm thinking of committing suicide. How do we know if somebody is considering ending their own life?
I don't think there's a checklist. I don't think we're ever going to know, but I do think that there are signs. And at Living Works and through our assist trainings, we actually call them invitations. And I think that's a really good analogy, because it really is an invitation for help. So someone who is struggling with thoughts of suicide is looking to live. And I know about people who are having thoughts of suicide is somewhere deep down they want to live, and all they really want is for someone to help them. So if they're sending out invitations for help, we as caregivers need to pay attention to those. And usually when we're talking about kind of signs or invitations, it's things like thoughts, how the person is thinking, how they're feeling, and some of the actions that they do. Things like, you'll often hear them say things like, I wish I were dead, or, you know, they'll give away possessions and say, I don't need these things anymore. One of the red flags for me is often when someone says, I feel hopeless. Mm. When you think about how many times you ever use the word hopeless in a sentence, especially when you're talking about yourself, it's not something that we throw around very often. So when I hear someone say hopeless, that seems to raise a little bit of a flag for me. For young people, you often hear them say, you know, I'm so confused. Just because someone is confused doesn't mean that they're having thoughts of suicide. But when you add that to circumstances in their life, maybe losses they've experienced in their life, you know, as a CYW, you're looking at working with kids in care, so they've had a lot of loss sometimes. when you're starting to add all those things together, that's when you start to think, maybe this is more than a bad day. Maybe this is, they're having thoughts of suicide.
I want to talk a bit about certain people that might be at higher risk. People in care. I know in Canada, for example, Aboriginal communities, some Aboriginal communities, not all Aboriginal communities, some Aboriginal communities, particularly in the north, I know that people, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender people, particularly those who are street involved. Are there other groups of young people in North America or elsewhere in the world that we know are at particular risk of suicide?
I think that, you know, there are different studies in all different areas that will indicate whether a person might be at higher risk. The way we measure it is, where have there been the most suicides? We really break it down to the basics of where have there been the most. So the highest risk group, the highest number of suicides per capita per year, is Aboriginal teen males in Canada. That's the highest. When you look at professions, dentists and air traffic controllers, they're at the top of the list based on their stress levels. And, you know, if someone is in a job or a profession that has an enormous amount of stress and an enormous amount of responsibility, and then you add, you know, the loss of a spouse or a divorce or, you know, a loss of a child or even just so many other contributing factors, when you start adding those together, it raises their level. The one thing that we always say in trainings, though, is, you know, we can focus on all of the groups out there that are at higher risk, but what happens if we only focus on Aboriginal teen male dentists, let's say?
Right?
What happens if we only focus on that group? Well, we forget about everyone else. So what we try and do is really encourage people to think that anyone can be at risk at any time.
And if 8 and 10 adolescents in high school are thinking about it, then clearly everybody is at risk.
It could be. Everyone could be at risk. It all depends on things that happen in our life. And sometimes it's interesting because people will come into our trainings and say, yeah, I could never be at risk. There's no way. I would never even, suicide would never cross my mind. But when you start talking about, well, what if this happened and this happened and then, oh, and then this happened tomorrow and then another thing happened, then people start to think, wow, maybe, right? You don't really ever know.
So you talked about some things that could happen. Loss has come up again and again. I know certainly breaking up relationships, for example, or the death of a loved one. Are there other circumstances that those of us who are caregivers need to be particularly aware of that might increase someone's risk of suicide?
I think that any major change in someone's life could put them at risk. Often trauma, especially in young people, any type of trauma can put them at a higher risk. But I would never say that someone's on a risk scale.
Right.
Right, just because things happen. It's all about how we manage them. So when we're working with young people, if we can help them manage some of those things that are coming at them, you know, it might lower their risk for suicide. Usually, the reason we talk about loss the most is because people don't realize how many things in their lives are connected to feelings of loss. Right? So things that put people at higher risk are things like, you know, losing your job or breaking up with a loved one or being moved from home to home. That essentially is a loss, right? You get comfortable, you're in a place, and then you get moved. Or picking up and moving schools, let's say, to another area. That's a loss. Kids that are coming out when they're struggling with gender identity or sexual orientation, that's a huge loss of identity for them sometimes, and it really leaves them exposed. So we, you know, if we're paying attention and we're aware, we can start pulling all those pieces together, because the young person might not be able to do that.
Assist doesn't see the role of the caregiver to talk somebody out of that. So as somebody is experiencing this loss, as somebody is dealing with these very, very difficult roles, Assist doesn't see the position of a caregiver to convince someone not to commit suicide, convince them not to end their life. Could you explain a little bit more about that? I know some people struggle with that idea.
Yeah. And I think it's really all in the wording. Our goal in the end is to save that person's life. Our goal in the end is for that person to live. And I would say that any effort that we make is a good effort, and it makes, you know, it makes us ready and willing to help that person. We would never, you know, get halfway through the process and say, okay, well, you've made up your mind, so I don't, you know, okay, well, I'm not going to talk you out of it. I think it's in the language. I think our goal as caregivers, especially when we're using the assist model, is to identify when someone's having thoughts and really ask the hard question. So that's what it really breaks down to. And once you know you're talking about suicide and this person's thinking about ending their life, the biggest part is to sit and listen to their story, because that's really what they want. They really want for you to sit and listen to them. They want to be heard, because maybe no one's listened to them in the past, or maybe this is the first time they've ever told someone that they're having thoughts of suicide. So what we really try and do is frame it in a way for people so they feel like, as a caregiver, their job is to sit and listen and be compassionate, instead of firing questions at someone or trying to give this person options. There's a time for that. It's just not necessarily guided by the caregiver, right? So right. The person at risk really needs to take their time, tell us what they're thinking, and then, you know, sometimes in that conversation, of course, we're going to give suggestions, but really we have to remember that it's all about this person at risk, and they've opened up to us as a caregiver. So we need to sit and listen to that. And then, not to say that we're not going to help them in every way we can, but we're going to help them by directing them to help themselves.
Right, rather than removing the control from their life further, we're there to facilitate, you know, them making a decision to continue living.
That's right, and that's what we want to do. We want them to continue living, and we might be a very good resource for that person, but sometimes we can't always be the perfect resource, so we have to work at finding other supports for that person and helping that person continue to live. We need to help teach them the skills to live instead of, you know, taking them by the hand and telling them how they're going to live.
Right. I want to come back to this idea about teaching them the skills to live, but before I do, we, as caregivers, we're attentive. We see, you know, changes in a person's life, loss, for example. Mm-hmm. We see these invitations for help. You talked about asking the hard questions. Mm-hmm. How do we do that? How do we approach someone we're concerned about?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's not an easy thing to do. In all of the interventions I've ever done, I don't think it's ever been easy. and we hear that a lot. It's probably the hardest question you ever ask. But you have to be willing to do it. And my advice to people who are going to ask someone, are you thinking about taking your life, or are you thinking about suicide? When you're ready to ask that question, you also have to be ready for the answer. And I think that's the hardest part for people. Especially as a caregiver, because something in your gut is going to tell you that this is more than a bad day.
Right.
They're going to say something, they're going to do something that makes you think, I think they're going to take their life, and I need to know. I want to help them. So you get to the point where you feel like, okay, I need to ask the question. But again, actually asking is very difficult. The one thing we always say, though, is you have to ask clearly and directly. You have to ask it as clear as you possibly can. If you beat around the bush and you make it fluffy, it's really hard for the person who's having thoughts to decipher whether you're the person they want to talk to.
The more clear and confident and present we can be, the more we indicate to them that they can trust us, we're there to support them, and we are going to stick through them, with them.
Yeah, we're not just going to ask and walk away, right? We're going to ask and we're in it for the long haul. And sometimes that long haul does take a long time. Sometimes it's hours. When you do, I mean, I've done interventions that last, you know, 2 and 3 days.
Wow.
Because you're constantly contracting with this person over and over to make sure that they're safe and to make sure that they're okay.
So you gave two examples. Are you thinking about taking your life? Are you thinking about killing yourself? Mm-hmm. Those can sound very direct and very abrupt to people.
Yeah.
Is there a way to to know when it's okay to ask that question from a young person? And I also, well, let's start there. Is there a, you know, because I can imagine, you know, someone says something and I say this and it takes them by shock and they get surprised and then get defensive, perhaps.
I think that you wouldn't ask it at a time where the person would appear shocked.
Right.
I think that, you know, things will happen. You'll start to see invitations. There'll be a little bit of a lead up in your discussion. And you're going to get yourself to the point where you feel like you need to ask. And this person won't feel like it's out of left field. One really good tip, one really good way to ask is to be able to say back to that person all of the invitations that you've been seeing. So, you know, with some of the kids that I work with, I can say to them, okay, so you're really angry and you've stopped texting me and, you know, you're making really weird statuses on Facebook and you're skipping class all the time. And I know that you broke up with your girlfriend and I feel like you've been pretty sad for the last couple of months. So sometimes when that happens, people think about suicide. Are you thinking about suicide?
Right.
If you can connect it to all of the reasons why you're asking, sometimes it's easier for people to understand. And they might feel blindsided. They might kind of feel like, oh, I didn't even realize I was broadcasting all of that. But if they are thinking about it, the odds are they're going to be really honest with you and say yes.
That's nice, framing it with the invitations that they've given. So sometimes, you know, working with young people, you'll hear, oh my God, life isn't worth living. Oh my God, I'm going to kill myself. And sometimes we'll hear that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And we often talk about suicidal ideation, thoughts of suicide, which are very common, 8 in 10, you know, unbelievably, thankfully, you know, 8 in 10 do not act on those thoughts.
Absolutely.
So there's ideation, thinking about it, there's a plan, there's a ways to enact that plan. That's often how we think of it as a professional caregiver. Can you explain a little bit about that idea to us and how we know what, you know, how concerned we should be or what the next steps are?
Well, I think that when you kind of go into an intervention, it's all about the conversation you're having with that person. So naturally, you're going to move, as you kind of learn about intervention, naturally you're going to start asking questions about a plan. A plan could be anything as immediate as, you know, after school today, I'm going home to take my life with a gun. That could be a very concrete plan. It could be that, or it could be the other end of, you know, I've really been thinking about it and I've been stockpiling pills that I've had, or, you know, my mom has pills in the cabinet that I've been thinking about taking. So that plan isn't as concrete and immediate. And I think that's what changes your level of risk, right? That's where, and as the caregiver, the only way to gauge your level of risk is to listen to what they're saying and you gauge yourself. If someone says to you they have a weapon and they're doing it today, your anxiety is going to be through the roof. If someone is pretty wishy-washy about their plan, you at least have your anxiety is a little bit lower and you feel like you have a little bit more time to work with this person. It's sometimes hard to gauge the level of severity. But we always say that, you know, every thought of suicide is important. Every thought of suicide should be taken seriously. When someone's having thoughts, though, they need to be addressed in some way. So sometimes it's just a matter of a conversation with a young person to say, you know, I know you're thinking about this, and tell me why you're thinking about this, and what got you to this point, and, you know, how are we going to get you some help so that you don't make a plan, so that you don't get to the point where you feel that there's no way out.
I think that's it's a really nice way of framing it. You used the term earlier about teach them how to live. So we see these invitations, we notice them, we reframe the invitations back to the person, we ask that difficult question, are you thinking about killing yourself? We find out if they have a plan, a means to enact that plan. How do we listen, we stay with them. How do we move into that place of teaching the young person how to live?
often it's about asking them, what works for you? When you're, you know, let's just say that the plan is not concrete and immediate. And you ask that young person, so what works for you? What do you do when you're stressed? I know some people feel like in an intervention, you need to only be, you know, talking about suicide and you only need to be focusing on how to keep them safe. And you do, but it's also a matter of a real, very present conversation. And it's okay to ask them things like, you know, what works for you? Do you use a journal? Do you, you know, do you listen to music? That kind of thing. What's going to work for you right now? You know, is there something that you're looking forward to? Maybe we need to work towards that. You can address some of the actual invitations. I mean, you're never going to say to a young person that's broken up with his first love, it's okay, you're going to get, you know, it'll be fine, you'll get a new one. Let's get you a new girlfriend. You're never going to say that to that person, but you can address some of those feelings of loneliness and hopelessness. And for young people, a buddy system is always really great. So saying to that person, who can you talk to? If you can't talk to me, who can you talk to? And if they say no one, then that's when you start offering them other suggestions. Maybe, have you ever called the crisis line before? They're totally anonymous. You can call them whenever you want, and they're willing to sit and talk with you. Oh, sometimes that's pretty appealing to mm-hmm. young people, right? So I think that, you know, help showing them those skills isn't about that hand-over-hand teaching them life skills. It's really about helping them identify the skills they already have. Right, kids have all of these great coping skills. They just don't always tap into them. So you might have to point them out. You might have to say to them, you know what, when this happened last time, I feel like, you know, you spending an hour in your room reading every night was really helpful. Or, you know, going to the gym was really helpful for you. So why don't we try that today? Sometimes when kids are having thoughts of suicide, it can be such an ongoing process. Especially when you're working with them on a regular basis, it can be a matter of having to kind of reapply that skill over and over and over.
Assist works all around the world and in Toronto and Southern Ontario. And, you know, we have people who come here from all around the world. Are there particular cultural factors that we need to be aware of? We have listeners from pretty much all the continents. Mm-hmm. You know, are there specific things that are uniquely Canadian or North American or specific to other countries that people should be aware of?
Well, actually, Living Works has done a lot of work in some of those areas, in particular in Aboriginal communities in the north in Canada. They struggle very much with using the word suicide. In their culture, it's not necessarily a word that you use very often. So sometimes assist can be a really hard sell for certain cultures and for certain communities. And Living Works has actually developed all of their training materials in Innu and in different communities in the north. They just frame it in a really different way. I was involved in a training with a group of Aboriginal youth, and they say things like giving your life away, which is, to us, what, here I am saying to you, be clear as possible and use the word suicide and talk about death. But for them, that is just as impactful because that wouldn't be something that would come up in a normal conversation, right? That would be something... giving your life away essentially means suicide. It right. means to die. So there are different, in different cultural aspects, there are definitely some ways to still make it work, because suicide is not unique to North America. Suicide is everywhere. Mm-hmm. There are just different views about how we feel about suicide. But I have to say, I mean, there's been amazing success around the world with a program like Assist. The difference with Assist is that it is a tool that you can use and apply in many different ways. It's like in a counseling session, someone said it to me recently, it's like a tool that you can if you're in a counseling session, you can kind of pull it out of your back pocket and insert it here, use it until you feel that you're at a place where that person's safe, and then you pull it out and you continue your work with that person. So it's like a model that you can apply and take away. So in different cultures, the ongoing process may be different, but the fundamentals of making sure that you know that that person's thinking about taking their life and knowing how to help them stay alive is really the skill that you need.
Right.
And there are ways to do that for sure.
And if somebody wants to, you know, because obviously a half-hour podcast is nowhere near enough time, that you gave us unbelievably helpful things, or believably helpful things, I should say. You know, where would somebody go for more information or for further training if someone was interested?
So if you are anywhere around the world, you can contact Living Works. They have a great website, and you can contact them. There are thousands of trainers around the world who do trainings on a regular basis. Here in Ontario, people can contact me. Usually the Canadian Mental Health Association has assist trainers, so they offer trainings in their area. And, you know, assist is really for everyone. It's not designed just for caregivers. It's not just designed for counselors. It really is designed for the average person who has encountered someone who's having thoughts and doesn't know what to do. Anyone can do this, and anyone can apply this model. It is really very, very real and very almost simplistic. Like, we just break it down in a way that makes sense for people, and it's about the person at risk. It's not about you needing all these special skills and a magic wand to make sure that you help someone. It's about making sure that that person can stay alive. So they can contact Living Works for a training pretty much anywhere, or in Ontario they can contact me, and there's lots of other opportunities. The other piece, there is Assist, which is a two-day suicide intervention training, and that's about teaching you the intervention skills. That's about actually intervening when someone says to you, yes, I'm having thoughts. The other training program that's really helpful for people is called Safe Talk, and it's about 3.5 hours, and it is about suicide alertness. So it's about teaching people about the invitations and asking the question and then connecting them with an assist-trained person or connecting them with someone who can help them, because maybe you're not the person, right? Maybe you don't feel like it's like you're able to do that work, or maybe you don't feel like you're the right person for that job. Connecting them to a professional or connecting them to a crisis line or whatever. And sometimes 2 days of training is hard for people to get out of work. And so this Safe Talk is always a good option as well. It's just not as in-depth and has a bit of a different focus.
I think that's a really important point, that some of us don't have the training, don't have the skills, you know, don't, you know, you said you need to be ready to stay with that person. And I know you've done training for hairdressers and tattoo artists, and, you know, they're not necessarily prepared to stay with that person for the next 2 or 3 days as they exactly. work through their stuff. Right. And that we need to know ourselves, and we need to know what we are able to do. And if we're not able to do that, you know, identifying, being able to ask the question, and then linking that person is a completely legitimate, valid, helpful option. We don't need to fix the person or stay with the person necessarily.
Yeah, and it depends on what your role is. If you are a counselor, your role is somewhat different.
Yeah.
But if you are someone who just wants to be aware and just wants to identify people who are having thoughts and be able to address it in some way, Safe Talk can be a really great option for that. And again, it speaks to that stigma. It speaks to reducing the stigma around the world. The more we talk about it, the more we, I hate to say normalize, but the more we normalize the word suicide, the more we're going to realize that people in our lives are thinking about it. You don't realize how many people around you on a daily basis are thinking about it. I often think about, you know, elderly people. They don't talk about it very much, but I'll tell you, they're thinking about it. They think about it a lot. So, you know, when you're in a room with, you know, a whole cross-section of people, you want to have that skill if you need it.
Yes, indeed. thank you very, very much for sharing these thoughts, this really practical advice, and giving us resources to go forward with. Is there anything else that I've missed that you think is important to say before we end this conversation?
I don't think so. I would encourage people to not be scared of attending a training, or don't be scared to go to a workshop that talks about suicide, because it is something that happens every day, and it is something that happens around us. It's not something that happens out there. It's right here in the room that you're sitting in. People think about it at some point in their life. So, don't be afraid to do that.
Wonderful. Hopefully people have a little less fear, and if they do still have fear, that they'll get the training required to be able to effectively listen and see the invitations, and then know what to do once they receive them. Thank you very, very much, Sonia, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Great, thanks very much.